This is Corey Colbert. I am the Mathematics Club Coordinator. My primary duty this semester is to make sure that we have the speaker every Wednesday and make sure we are all full at 5:30 or 7 p.m. with pizza. Well, anyway, we have many speakers here today. It's my pleasure to introduce our panel here that will talk to us about graduate school, getting into graduate school, getting through graduate school, and beyond. So if I could get, and we're missing one panelist at the moment, but anyway, if I could get all of the panelists to introduce themselves, that'd be great. Yes.
Okay, Elisa Bast, I'm the graduate program coordinator. Yes, I do the administrative work for the program.
Yeah,
and
then
I'm here. Hi, I'm Catherine Dax, I'm a fifth year graduate.
Jamie
Poole,
I just graduated this August.
And hi, so I'm teaching usually the one of the probability Berlin courses here.
And we're all good.
Yeah, hi, my name's Andy, I'm just the first year.
Great. So we've got a really cool panel here. So I'm going to, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask them some questions first, and we'll get to hear their responses. After that, we're going to open it up to you all to ask the panel whatever you like. You can ask me a question too, but you know, ask the panelists here, your special guests. So I'll start with you, Andy. So your first year.
Yeah, first year.
Tell us what it was like applying. Did you have to take any exams? Did you have to find, you know, how did you find letters of recommendation? And
oh man, yeah, that's a loaded question. There's so many, so if you're asking me like how to apply to grad school, what to watch out for, there's a lot to talk about there. I think the quick and easy breakdown is that you need letters of rec and you need to take GREs and fill out some applications for grad school. That's also what it is. Make sure you take the GREs on time, like make sure that deadline doesn't get ahead of you. Make sure you get some letters of rec, and then make sure you fill out those applications. Yeah, each one of these, though, there's a lot of detail to go into.
And for getting the letters of recommendation, I know this can be a very difficult thing for many people because they, you know, may not, you know exactly who to ask and, you know, how to go about that. So how did you go about getting your letters of recommendation?
Yeah, great. That is a huge, very, very important question. So I can only speak from my own experience. But back in my school, I was told that the letters of rec are the most important part of your application. They mean more than most of the other components. So you need to get letters of rec from professors who can write good things about you. Specifically, what the professors write is what I was told, that they write about your ability to, your potential to be a good researcher. So the best letters of rec come from people that you've done research work for or some kind of special reading coursework for. So that way they can write nice, like, factual statements. This person worked on me for this project and got this result. It's an amazing result, and you should really take the suit. So I highly recommend, and this is some stuff that I myself tried and some of my friends did as well, is you do, like, an RE over a summer. Just, that seems to be trending toward the norm, is what I've been told. A lot of undergraduates these days do, like, some kind of research experience, and RE is one option. Other options are like a directed reading with a professor during the school year, or maybe a directed project if you want. But just do something where you work on like a research type project, so that way it gives them some kind of material that they can write their letter of rec for. And you might want to start thinking about that in your sophomore or junior year, because you're going to need some time to actually get some results on the project. Are you guys familiar with REUs? All right, so that's probably important to mention. This is one option you can do to get like a letter of rec. There, the NSF, the National Science Foundation, gives out funding to various schools in the summers, and these schools will host these summer math camps where they invite a bunch of college students in to do research projects for some of the professors there. You usually have to start looking for these things sometime like around winter break, I believe, and you can find them by going to the Google searching NSF Math REU, and you you can look at one of like the first links there, and it'll probably be the link I'm referring to. It's just a long list of schools that host our youth center programs. And each one usually has like an application where you have to write a personal essay about what got you interested in math and why you wanted to do this project. And yeah, they're good experiences. And I'm told a lot of people these days go into grad school, they write their applications and they have like some kind of research experience to put on. So that seems, you don't need it, like it's not like absolutely necessary, but a lot of people tend to have it. So it might be good to have too. Does that answer that?
Yeah, I think there's some very good information. Very good information. I would add also, when it comes to letters of recommendation, like it is never a good time to ask a professor for a letter of recommendation the day before it's due, for example. That's bad practice. Okay. And some of them will say, yeah, sure, I'll write one, and it will be a not very good letter for you, right? So it's good. I think Andy gave us some great information, and I'd say it's very good to make sure you give plenty of time to your recommendants to write their letters, at least, I mean, at the very least 2 weeks, at the very, very, very long. But I actually recommend even more than that. Very cool. Catherine, clear the air for us. So Catherine and I were both fifth years, and when I was a first year, I didn't really know the fifth years. I didn't know, you know, what they were doing, where they were, because they weren't really in the prelim classes with me. And so I was like, well, where are they? Now that, you know, I guess we are fifth years, we kind of understand this a little bit better. So if you could tell us a little bit about what it's like to be in the senior part of graduate school and sort of what you do or what you're doing, and things like that.
So at this point, I guess, so 9 hours is like the standard full time graduate student. So 6 of those hours for me at this point, I'm in candidacy, are just dissertation hours. So that's working with my advisor and trying to figure out some math and writing. So that's what probably like most of my time is spent doing. I am also in a class, but it's like a seminar class. So definitely like less formal than like a prelim class. There isn't like homework that I'm turning in every week. It's just go over lectures and, you know, work on stuff on my own to make sure I learn it. So that's like what my actual schedule is. Then on top of that, I'm a TA, so this semester I'm grading. In the past I've been, you know, a fabulous TA or something like that.
Very cool. So it's a lot less, you know, the time is a lot less structured when you're like, you know, if you're first year just coming in and you're in the prelim system, then you've got a lot of courses you have to take and you spend a lot of time doing a lot of homework and these kinds of things and get ready for the prelim exams. But then when you make it to, you know, when we're past that system, you spend, you know, a lot of time just.
Yeah, so like as far as like actual schedule things that I have to do at a certain time and place, I have like very few of those. So like most of my time is very like flexible, and I have to decide what I should be spending that time on, and how I should be managing my time. It's definitely difficult, but
very cool.
I think also at this point, though, in the classes that you take, so your dissertation hours are credit, no credit, basically, and your other class that you take is credit, no credit, or not, depending on how you want to do it. But from the administrative point of view, we don't care if she's taking it third grade or not. So at this point in her career, she should be doing her own thing.
Yeah, like at this point, for at least for a little while now,
Yeah, and that's true for the requirements of the PhD program, like being the administrative side. They don't monitor whether or not she's taking classes for a grade or not. It's just not, that's not the ideal outcome at this point.
So, Jamie, you said you just graduated in August, right?
Yeah.
Congratulations. All right, very cool.
No longer a student.
So
first time ever.
tell us a little bit about what it's like when it comes to writing this really big dissertation and what that's all about, and if you could also comment a little bit on, like, you know, applying for jobs and how that all works, that'd be great too.
So, you go to grad school, you take these prelim classes. I thought, like, those exams were, like, going to be the worst part of grad school. I really did. I got past it. I was doing research with my advisor. I was like, I like my research. This is great. The last, like, 4 months writing my dissertation was the worst 4 months of the process. And I think what happens varies probably by professor, by school. I know some people who got their math degrees at other schools, they literally take some papers that got published, staple them together, and turn it in. My advisor is like, no, I want to see, like, this really cohesive group of work. So you've done this stuff, but we're not going to include it, and we're going to do this other stuff instead. And so it's kind of like pulling something together, and it's hard. I mean, you end up writing a long document from scratch, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of time, and it kind of culminated, like, everything I had done in my time here somehow got put in there. Even, like, some of the prelim course stuff, I would, like, come back and use part of that to do something. So it's over. If you're in the process and you get there, I mean, you just kind of got to crank through those last few months. I haven't talked to anyone who was like, yeah, the last few months were easy. We're all trying to hit a deadline. We all want our committee to, like, approve, like, yeah, you did a good job. So applying for jobs. I haven't started yet. I'm currently teaching here, and they offered me the lecture position before I finished, so that was nice. So I wasn't that worried about jobs as I was finishing. I'm going to be applying for academic positions with all the other students who are graduating this year. So normally those come up. There's an NSF postdoc fellowship, and that application I think is due at the end of this month. And then most of the postdocs that start in the fall have deadlines kind of around December. So I'll be right back in the position where you guys are in, where I'm, like, going around asking people for recommendations, writing letters, being like, hey, this is why you should take me. So,
yeah. Cool. Very cool. Yeah. Awesome. So I want to now ask Professor Sirbu a question. So pretty much, well, I guess I suspect everybody in the audience is an undergraduate. What would you say is the biggest difference in undergraduate coursework from graduate coursework? What would you say is sort of the biggest difference, you know, especially with respect to what's required of students or what you expect of graduate students?
I would say probably the biggest difference would be, on one hand, like, the level of difficulty. Obviously, it's more difficult if they graduate coursework. But more important than this, I would say, is that the level of rigor, which means that everything is proof-based. And in the undergrad, there is some stuff which is proof-based, but it's very kind of limited inside. And the real thing is, like, everything has to be proof-based. So this is, like, the qualitative difference, yeah? And then, of course, it's more difficult. But for people that like it, it's probably more. All people that want to apply for grad school related to math, which is a good thing, yeah? So the main difference is everything has a proof and has to be correct. Yeah. And from there, yeah, of course, you're in different places. But this is, like, about coursework, this would be the most important difference, I would say.
Is there anything that you could recommend to people that are going to graduate school to better, you know, prepare prepare themselves for the level of rigor of graduate coursework or to be successful in graduate courses?
So related to just what's the most important thing, but this is probably, it may be too late now, so even earlier in the undergrad studies, not at the end, just before, so probably if there is something like an undergraduate course which is proof-based, just try to take it, even if it's completely different from the kind of math that you like or not. It's like just take something which is proof-based and then take upper-level undergraduate courses, which is, they kind of even overlap a little bit with graduate classes sometimes, so try to take like proof-based classes and more difficult classes in the area that you think you may be interested in. So in the beginning, just do something proof-based, whatever that is, yeah. And then try to take more and more difficult, and if possible, also proof-based courses closer to what you would like to do later.
Yeah, and I'd actually even add to that as well. I mean, I think many of you are doing this already, taking graduate courses while you're an undergrad.
Yeah.
So you'll get exposure to what it's like to be course, especially here at the University of Texas. I mean, this is a pretty competitive school, and taking one of our graduate courses, if you go to a similarly competitive school for graduate school, you'll kind of have a feeling for what the demands of graduate coursework will be like. And again, I see a lot of you doing already. That's very, very good. So, all right, great. So, you're in graduate school. Graduate school has started. You got in, and all of this. And you are an international student. And, you got into an American graduate school, say. And so, what is it, what are the things that you have to do? What's it like? Do you have any special forms you have to have? So, Elisa, could you comment on that for us?
It's a lot of forms. I can speak in particular to what UT requires that you do. We recommend that our international students get here about mid-July. That's the most useful thing for them. They have to get a visa prior to that. But in that process of being here, they have entirely different orientations that they are required to go to. There's international TA certification that has to happen for them. If English is not their first language. There's a whole host of things that have to happen before they start their job September 1st. And then there's a little bit of leeway after that, but if they don't get a lot of those things taken care of before September 1st, then they may not get paid October 1st. So that can be like a difficult thing because you have to get your Social Security card, you have to show your eligibility to work in the U.S., and all of these other things. There's like government things that have to happen, then there's UT things that have to happen, and then there's your department things that have to happen. So there's a bunch of people sending a lot of different emails. I would say that to make a smooth transition for an international student at an American school, clear your calendar from June to August, read every single email that's ever sent to you, and read every single website link that's being sent to you as well, because there is so much detail provided on all these websites, and you'll be really tired of reading it, but it's going to have the most up-to-date information. And then there should be an international office for every student at their university, and they should be the liaison to help international students. But, yeah, bring lots of money. The international office tells students to do that, bring lots of money at first, because they don't get paid. People don't get paid until October 1.
Great. So,
let me add one thing. A lot of our international students looked at our website, found students that had similar, they looked at their websites and Skyped them. They just called them and said, or emailed them and said, can you Skype with me and tell me what it's like? What Austin is, what should I look for, and everything. And that really was helpful for them. So I recommend that. Students love to talk to you.
Yeah, true. So I'm going to open it up to the floor for questions directly to our panel. You can ask anyone, or you can ask the whole panel, whatever, anything you like about graduate school or what it's like, all these kinds of things. So, yeah, anyone. Popcorn style, just go.
So, what are some things you guys recommend for, just freshmen right now in college looking forward to maybe going to grad school and beyond, things we should start doing now as freshmen to kind of prepare for that.
I don't go back to what I said basically. So if there is something proof based, try to take it, and then try to take the more advanced versions of the courses that you can take, because there are different sections of calculus and different things, and some of them they are a little bit more difficult than others. Try to always go for the most difficult thing possible. And closer to the end of the graduate studies, the undergrad, it goes back to the fact that he was absolutely right, Andy, that the recommendation letter is a very important part of the application. And what I wanted to say is that sometimes maybe you don't have the time to do some research or do reading or whatever, but it can still be okay. But what I wanted to say is not only what kind of letter you get, but the obvious thing is whoever writes it is very important. So if you see it in, let's say, upper undergraduate class, and somebody pretty famous teaches it, if you're at the top of the class and you can get a letter from that particular professor, this can get you in a graduate school probably better than even an IU program or something. So I don't want to say names, because I don't want to blame him. All these guys are asking letters from me. It's obvious, yeah. So there are different names whose name count more on a letter. So this is quite important. But this is like the political side of the aspect, whatever, the administrative. But the real thing is, take group as classes in the beginning, and then the most difficult version of whatever is offered that you like, obviously.
I agree with Professor Kruger 100% on that. In particular, when it comes to getting those letters, talking to faculty members early, actually, I think the great thing about being like a freshman or sophomore and thinking about graduate school is that you have time to start building relationships with faculty members in the department. This is what I was doing when I was like in 10th, sophomore year. I took courses with, just like Dr. Zuber said, I took courses that, I took like analysis or something like this, and I talked to the professor a lot, and I would just go to his office hours whenever, randomly, just talk about the problems or just talk about math in general. And the letters are a lot better if they know you on that level. Just getting an A in the class, that's good, and that's something they can obviously say. But knowing you on that deeper level is what makes it really, really good. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good question. Oh, yes, please.
I think
Professor
Kruger
also
mentioned that you have to take groups as classes in the beginning.
Requesting more detail on letters of recommendation. Say you have two undergraduate degrees and professors from like both fields. What would you optimize for? Whether the professor is reputed, whether you give you a good recommendation letter, or the fit with the graduate program that you're applying for? Which one? What's the order of ranking?
Jamie looks like she has.
I was an engineering student undergrad and not a math student. So I had this exact question, how do you do this? And I ended up taking one of my engineering professors who was famous in the field, who knew me, and then two math professors. Because at the end of the day, if you're applying to a math program, you need them to be able to speak, can this person do proofs, right? Can they handle these things? And other topics, you're not really going to be able to address that as well. They might be able to say, yeah, you're a smart person, but it's not as on point to can you handle math graduate work, and they're going to be different, right?
So basically, you have to have a few math professors, mainly math professors.
I mean, I don't know if someone might say something else, but that's where I would read it, and I would do the same thing again, is not take more than one professor outside of math for a math degree. Now, if you're engineering and you're bioengineering and bio and engineering professors, you know, I don't know. But for math, right, as he's saying, like, you do proofs, so you need someone who can comment on that skill set.
And also, on top of this, I fully agree with what you said, but on top of this, somebody would be reasonably quite famous in the field, but because they have any field, they don't communicate as well as people think, and something this person may not be so famous in this other field. See? So fame is relative in academia, it's not like politics. Being famous in one field doesn't mean that everybody else in a different field is like another person. So in the end, so if you apply to graduate school, you absolutely, I would say, you need to have at least the majority of the letters from math. It's very good if you have some and famous one from engineering or something. It will certainly help, but at least half, maybe more, should be from math, I would say. But yeah, there is no dividing line, but yeah, some at least.
Okay. So the other part of the question was, do you get a professor who's less famous but knows you well and has good things to say? Or, like, what would be the proportion of famous but, you know, not too close persons?
So this is like the quantitative aspect of deciding which one is this is kind of complicated. So the answer is I don't really know. It's on a case-by-case basis. At the end of the day, it's always, there is always randomness in anything, including like the graduate schools. So the answer is I don't know the answer to this question. It all depends how famous and how good. Yeah, but this is the honest answer is I don't know. So it's basically your common sense judgment.
I think for graduate advisor, he likes to say that this this is the career you're pursuing. Your entire career is going to be networking. Once you get your PhD, you're going to be looking for a job, and it's going to help you know who you talk with and who you work with. This is the very first start of that networking. So it's even helpful if you have a school you want to go to, and one of your professors that you've been working with knows someone at that school, that's even more helpful too, because then they can email and say, email my colleague, make sure you look at this application, that kind of thing. We give them all equal weight, but...
But the truth is, when somebody reads a graduate school application, if you see a name that you know well and you trust the name and you see a reasonable kind of recommendation, this is a good student, comes quite a lot more than somebody who writes, this is a wonderful student, but they are, you don't really know the person, right? That's the bottom line.
Did you have a question for you?
Oh, yeah. So I guess it was previously mentioned that, in grad school, after a certain point, grades don't really matter. So how important are they in, actually getting into grad school?
I mean, look at the whole package on the application. I'll let you
see
to that.
They're kind of important, but to the extent that if they are bad, they're going to preclude you from going to graduate school. But if it's, really at the very top or a little bit beyond the top, it's about the same. So I don't know. So they matter. So, I mean, if you have a low GPA, this is going to look kind of bad. But if your GPA is not 4.0, but 3.7, I would say it's about the same, almost the same. Yeah. So they carry some information, but only at the bottom. So this would be the answer.
Yeah, I mean, administratively, you have to have a 3.0 and above to get admitted. You can get admitted with conditions if it's below that, but that creates a lot of situations.
I did not even know this. And as long as you're above 3.0, if you do okay in the classes that matter to that particular graduate school, maybe your GPA is kind of low because you did poor in other things. So I would say it doesn't matter a lot unless it's better.
I will admit that if it were up to my non-math grades to get here, that someone else would be doing the panel today. So you had a question.
I just had a quick question about the letter. How many letters of recommendations are you expecting?
different programs do have different requirements. I've seen, I think I've seen maybe some programs somewhere that have two, and I thought that was a little unusual, but it's quite rare for two.
I'd say most places, maybe including the theory, formally ask for three at least, no?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that fourth one is not
yeah, yeah, no, at least three, yeah.
Just kind of piggybacking off of the grades question. So on the application, though, you guys tend to put more weight on the grades that they got, like in the math courses, than perhaps maybe our grades in other courses. Like, you know, like if we got like A's in our math courses, and then maybe like a B or a C in like acting course or something. So, like, I don't know. But something like so, you'll be like, okay, well they can do math, and they just have this.
I'm not on the admissions committee. I mean, I can tell you what I've heard from the faculty, but you can speak to that.
The only standard is the following. So there is already a GPA threshold above below which you don't qualify for grades, which is reasonably high. Beyond that, people look basically at letters and GN scores. Yeah.
Okay.
And if there is something kind of, they look, oh, this is, some cases are clear on one side or the other. If it's unclear, then you kind of look at GPA, but this is kind of reasonably rare. And then you, if somebody, oh, this is a borderline case, whatever, let's look at GPA. And this, oh, this GPA is about 3.0, but the math grades are bad, then the answer is no. If the grades are A in math and maybe whatever, C's in other things, it's okay. This, but so it matters, but a lot less than GREs and that's the answer.
I want to offer.
Which are correlated. Sorry, because at the end of the day, the letters are going to be correlated with the math grades to a reasonably large extent.
I want to offer, and I certainly invite Dr. Sirba to comment, or anyone else actually, to comment on this. I think, so, it's not necessarily smooth sailing for everybody for undergraduate, even math courses. So when I was in undergrad, like, I still love it now, but really just taking a lot of math courses and doing well, but my grandmother got sick one semester, and I ended up not doing well in one of my math courses. And so the advice that I was going around asking people, like, what do I do about this? What do I say? And the advice that I got from people on this is that, like, you know, you don't want the admissions committee to be wondering what went on there. So better be honest and say, this is what happened this semester. And clearly my other grades were fine, so clearly it's not like a pattern or something. But you don't, like, you know, if there's, and this goes for non-math, like if you got like all F's in all at one, you know, like in some non-math courses one semester or whatever, like that's something worth commenting on in your personal statement. Which actually, I don't think we talked much about personal statement. But that's actually worth commenting on. Not talking, don't spend the whole time talking about it, but that's worth commenting on. You know, I just say that because, like, you know, I feel like there's sometimes an a priori assumption that one is applying to graduate school, one must have gotten all A's and B's in all one's math courses, and I don't, and you know, that might be true for everybody in the room, but it wasn't true for me. And so, you know, for the individual that may not be in that situation, I say that it is good to be, for at least for me, this is what I was told, that it's good to be honest about, you know, whatever mistakes may have happened in the past, so that the committee is not, you know, wondering what happened, so that they'll know.
I just want to make a comment about grades, though, because I've made it sound like grades don't matter in graduate school, and it's actually not true. Once you're in candidacy, which is, you know, you've already passed your prelim exams and you've already done your coursework, grades are important the first 2 years. You have to do A's and B's there. After that, then you're in candidacy, fifth year.
But even for undergrad grades, what I wanted to say, just to make sure that grades don't matter. So basically, grades don't matter if they're A's and B's. If they're mostly B's, they don't matter. That's my point.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be all A's. Or yeah, it's okay to have some B's. You have a lot of C's, then it's a problem. It's a problem. Yeah.
What's the GRE like?
So, yeah,
I can talk about
perfect.
That. Okay. So the GRE, if you're applying to math grad school, the GRE is kind of like a couple of tests that you go to some testing center and you take. There are two. There's a general GRE, and then because you're applying to math, there's also a math GRE subject test. So there are two exams. You have to sign up for them like a month in advance, or a couple weeks in advance, but you can also, in some occasions when they have extra exams, you can just walk in. Usually you want to set this up, like you want to start thinking about taking them in either late summer or beginning of fall, and you want to start looking at the signups for those GRE exams. Content-wise, did you have specific questions that you wanted to know about the GRE?
Yeah, like content-wise, what is it?
Yeah.
At what point in your undergraduate did you think about it?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. All right. My friends and I, we didn't worry about the GREs until our senior year or so, when we were about ready to write our applications to grad school. I think if I remember high school correctly, we took like the SATs and the ACTs in junior year, I believe.
Yeah.
But for me and for my friends and I, we didn't take our exams until senior year, like in the fall semester of our senior year, or the summer right before our senior year to get it out of the way. The general is like the SAT kind of. You have to write essays for it, you have to do some very simple math problems, you have to do some very simple like analogies or like sentence construction grammar.
Depending on yours.
Yeah. So it's just it's like the SATs. The math subject test is the one that's really important, I think. I don't think, as far as I'm aware, in my experience, I don't think people really care about your general GRE scores. I think it's more so the grad schools, the math grad schools care a lot more about my math subject test scores. And so for the math subject test, it's a lot of the calculus, there's some linear algebra, and then there's very, very light, like theory stuff like with algebra, maybe some very, very rudimentary like real analysis. It's mostly a lot of multivariable counting. My advice for that is you definitely want to study hard for that and prepare for it. Did you have any other questions on that?
No, that's
good. Yeah.
I would suggest seriously studying with someone before your senior year for the math subject GRE test. You're not going to, I can walk in and take the standard GRE on math and do fine. You can't do that for the subject test. You got to go back and redo those problems and relook at it.
So it's a lot of multivariable calculus and just linear algebra.
That's my experience. So it's also multiple choice. Oh, and sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh,
can I say one more thing?
Sure, sure.
In my personal experience, if you can, like if you can afford it, because it costs like $100 or something, $50 to take it. There's a fee to take the test. But if you can afford to take it like multiple times, I suggest maybe signing up for multiple times. I had a friend who did that, and he was very, very lucky because he somehow got the same exam that he in his second take as the one they gave him on the first take. So there were questions. He said he went through it, and there were some problems where he's just like, "Oh yeah, I remember like question number 43 of his take." Like, so I didn't even like do the calculation again. I just circled it. So he did very well. And now he's very happy with his grad school.
I've got Dr. Chin right here on Skype so let's welcome him. So, Dr. Chin, can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Thank you very much, Corey.
Great. So, this is Dr. Chin. He is the graduate advisor, and he's the one that finalizes admissions and things like this. So, Dr. Chin, if you could give us some insights on how to be successful in applying to graduate school and whatever insights you'd like to offer us from your chair as graduate advisor, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you very much, Corey. So, hi, everybody. Thanks very much for having me here with your panel. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. So when you apply for a graduate program, you should be very well aware of the fact that it's actually people who make the selections. And when you apply to a place, there are two things perhaps that you should in particular keep in mind. First of all, any program that is well known has a lot of applications, hundreds of applications. And if you leave it up to chance, then your chance is one in a few hundred. Now, this is the point where knowing that people are making the selections really helps. Because if you apply to a place that really interests you, you should adapt your cover letter very carefully. You should be very much aware of who is doing what are the strengths of that program, who you want to work with, what subject you want to work with. And then in your cover letter, you should write that you would like to work with this and that professor on this and that problem or in this and that research area. So the way the selection works is as follows. There is a committee that has the task of selecting PhD students. They will ask all their faculty to check through the applications in their areas. And you know, when somebody reads an application and they see their name in it, you know, mathematicians are more objective than many other kinds of people, but mathematicians who still also have some level of vanity. So if you write somebody's name in it and you make them know that you are aware of what they are working on and you write, you have a great lot of admiration for what they are doing and you actually did look at their papers, this will give them the impression that you are a person they might really want to work with. Because you have to put yourself in their shoes. You have to think about, if you're a professor and you want to select a PhD student, what kind of PhD student would you like to have? You would like to select one about whom he or you have a good idea about their level of interest and direction of interest. And if you know that the student wants to work with you, then of course that makes that student special. And so if a faculty member gives the committee a special input about really wanting you as their student, this is helping your application tremendously. Another thing is, you should, so I don't know whether this is already the year in which you are applying, but you should have a good number of graduate courses on your curriculum. You should start taking graduate courses at some point. You should, if possible, take reading courses with faculty at some point. So if you're really sincere and very dedicated to having a career as a mathematician, then this is something which you have to start with at some point. This is helping you in your applications at the top level places. Not all places require this, but at the top level places, virtually all of the applicants have such background. So these are two things.
Great. So does anyone have a question for Dr. Chen?
I guess, so how do you kind of select a professor you want to work with?
Yeah, so how do you select a professor that you want to work with?
Do you have to, like, first find which school you would like to apply to?
You have to first find what school you have to apply to.
Or how do you do that?
Yes, so, you know, if you, let's say you apply to, I don't know, 20 schools, and among the 20 schools, maybe 10 are safety choices, and 10 are your, maybe 5 are your dream choices, and 5 are solid choices that you think, if you're lucky, then where you think those are at your level, and if you're lucky, you really have a solid chance to get in. Then, with those places where you're really sincere, or where you really want to get in, you have to study the websites Nowadays, you just go online, you study the faculty websites, you read what they write about themselves. You know, being successful in a job application, and this is kind of a job application, has nothing to do with luck. It has everything to do with preparation, with strategy, with timing, and with developing the skills necessary, what are the necessary job application skills? You have to look it up on websites. So you can talk to advisors here at the department. You can look up information just generally about job application. It definitely is an acquired skill. It is learnable.
So does anyone have any final questions for our panelists before we wrap up here?
What is, when you do personal statements and cover letters, what are some of the more boring things that you read, like over and over?
So the question was, what are some of the more boring things that you read in cover letters and personal statements?
Oh, you know, when students write, you know, when I was a boy, I was looking to the stars, and also, you know, I liked it when the unicorns came out at the same time. It's like, you know, you don't have to be a poet. As a mathematician, rarely mathematicians struggle with their English, so you don't have to be poetic in what you write. You should. So you have to know you're applying to a math program. What people want to know is that you are able to think coherently, strategize clearly, and that you have the maturity to know what is important in your application. And what is important is somehow the people want to see that you have mathematical ability. So if you did something in your past that relates to math, you should describe it. If you have some research experience, then you should write what it was about. If you are enthusiastic about some area in math, then you should express it. But if you are very general and start with, you know, your previous life in elementary school, then this is not what people want to see. The more you sound like a research mathematician already, the better it looks.
That's very true. Great. So do our panelists have any final comments they want to offer our undergraduates before we go upstairs and eat some pizza? Or?
Well, for me?
Anyone, I mean, if you want. Yeah.
Something that really helped me as an undergrad is definitely having like a mentor or talking to maybe the undergraduate advisor, or if you're lucky enough to have a professor who's willing to mentor you, that makes a big difference for me at least. And definitely bringing these types of questions in the future, if you have more questions like this, bring them to those types of people. There is an undergraduate advisor here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, probably like a faculty. Yeah, so you can definitely bring questions like this to them, and that.
Dr. Chin, did you have any final things you wanted to say before we wrap up?
Let me see. So, I don't know, who among you have attended to some graduate courses already? And who is in their application year already?
So we have about 3 hands, 4 hands-ish.
Okay. Who among you have know a faculty member who you can talk to? Yeah. So, you know, it would be, so my general the closing remark is, if you have a goal, then it's really worthwhile to plan very much ahead of time. So if you know your long-term goal is research math, you should start planning years ahead with whatever it is. Like, if you want to apply to grad school, then you should start planning 2 years ahead of time and do the right thing, because you can't do what is necessary just in half a year. So something that is really helpful is if you do reading courses, and if alone with doing that, you can ask the faculty to give you information on what is really necessary, where to apply. And if you do very well, actually, what one of the ways that worked best is if your advisor, if your faculty advisor knows a friend who meets a student and makes the link, that is usually the very best way to land a good position. So you have to plan ahead and do the right thing long time in advance.
Very cool. Well, let's give our panelists a round of applause. Thanks to all of you for coming here in the midst of your busy schedules. Dr. Chin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for doing this.
So we have pizza upstairs. We're free to go. Please go. We've got plenty of it. And it's great. See you next week.
Yeah. And thank you so much.